Hello and welcome to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. This is episode 4. We made it this far. Hey.
Woot.
I am your host, Wade Bojek, joined by David Ishida.
Hello.
And the great Ben Robertson.
I'm here.
The late, great Ben Robertson.
I was about to make the same joke.
Right. So today we are talking all about lenses. A very important topic, often brushed aside and skipped over, but is very important nonetheless, especially for the up-and-coming indie filmmaker.
Arguably one of the most important things.
And we will argue that today. So David has prepared a whole host of lenses for us to talk about in our Tools of the Trade segment starting off. And then we're going to talk about how to use said lenses in productive and artistic ways.
Specifically depth of field.
Yes. And then this month we saw the movie Sully, Clint Eastwood's latest film, and we will talk about that in great detail.
The late, great Clint Eastwood.
He's not late yet. He's soon there.
David gets his revenge. So starting off, we're going to talk about lenses. You have a kit of primes we're going to talk about, but we also have kind of an all-in-one zoom starter lens.
Right.
Let's start with that.
Okay, so the zoom lenses, very popular lenses for indie filmmakers to use. Why? Because you get a lot of focal lengths. Whether or not you actually zoom with them, you can, you know, you have a nice range to work with. And thusly, technically, in the certain sense, you have one lens that can cover all of your prime range versus having to have 5 or 6 primes.
So you save space on not having to lug around a kit, and you save time with not having to switch lenses out.
Yep, and money as well, because it's a lot cheaper.
Good for the guerrilla filmer.
Yes, exactly. And also, though, I will, real quick, if people don't know the difference between a zoom and a prime. A zoom lens is one that has a variable focal length, so that is like lenses you would often see on still cameras, so like an 18 to 135, a 70 to 200, a 16 to 35 lenses like that, so they can have a zoom in that range. And prime lenses are fixed focal length, so they, you know, you get a 50 millimeter and that's it. Oftentimes, you know, good portrait photographers usually shoot on primes for reasons that we'll get into in the next section. But the lens I wanted to start out with was the very new, I think it came out 2 months ago, maybe. No, actually it would have been about a month ago now.
Wow.
It is the new Canon 18 to 135 USM. That's ultrasonic motor for the techno nerds. It refers to the kind of motor that is on the inside that drives the focus. You're doing things like autofocus, it's the motor that runs that. The other version is an STM, which is a stepper or something motor. Mm-hmm. And that's just the older style. The newer ones are using these ultrasonic motors, so they're a little bit more of a refined movement on that focus.
And what cameras is this lens designed for?
This one is designed for EF lenses. So EF, or electronic focus, or for as many people call it, the Canon mount lenses. Mm-hmm. So they're designed for any Canon camera. I shouldn't say any. Most Canon cameras will use this lens. But, you know, if you're using something like the Panasonic GH4, the Sony A7N, so you would need to purchase some kind of an adapter to get from those native mounts to EF, which there are plenty of options.
So this is great for people who want to start off with maybe a DSLR, or if for whatever reason they have the C100 or C300, it could also work on those cameras.
Yes, correct.
Is this one of the kit lenses that comes with the DSLRs too?
Because
I know there is an 18-135.
Yes,
that was mine. Mm-hmm.
There was an older one. This is a newer one. I don't know if this is moving into that spot because, I'll get into what one of the cool things about this lens in a moment. But when you look at this lens, it is what we'd call a variable aperture. That means that the amount of light that the lens is letting in will change over the course of the zoom.
Right.
So this particular one is a 3.5 to 5.6. Not terrible. Mm-hmm. It could be better, but not terrible. But this particular lens will put you back around $600 for this one lens. If you are in the need of one that has a constant aperture the whole way through, then you're probably talking about a grand more. You're talking about $1,600, $2,000 for one of the lenses that has the same aperture the whole way through.
Yeah.
So as a result, you do need to deal with that. So if you're doing a shot that you are zooming on, you want to go from a nice wide and you want to actually do a zoom to push in to someone, you are going to see a light loss. Mm-hmm. And you either need to, at the same time, be compensating with ISO or shutter to try and keep it a little more constant, or you need to just be okay with the light loss.
Or, a lot of cameras have just internal, like, auto mode, I guess. They'll like correct the look of it.
Yeah, yes, that's true. Yeah, some of them will do something like that.
Not to say it won't be noticeable.
Yeah, exactly. You know, with some cameras, you know, when you're having to, especially if you're indoors and if you have less than ideal lighting, because you have to be pushing the ISO up higher, you'll probably get more noise and as a result. But this one is really nice. I really like, and this is actually one that I'm looking at buying myself for my, mainly for my still camera, because it is a really nice range. You have a decently wide 18 millimeter.
Yeah, which is like slightly fisheye, 24.
Not quite.
Or 24 millimeter, isn't that like default, like human eye level?
I don't know if it's quite human, but yeah, 24 is what everybody likes to shoot on. It's a wonderful, wonderful focal distance. So it's a little bit wider than that, so you can get a decent wide. It's not a great wide. Like, you know, if you want a good wide without going fisheye, you probably want to get to more like a 16 millimeter. Mm-hmm. And 2 millimeter difference in focal range, in focal distance, doesn't sound like much, but it makes
when you
a
get
big
that
difference.
Low, it does. Yeah. When you get higher up,
yeah, not exactly. So but with this, then you have a really nice push in, because there are some cheaper lenses that's like an 18 to 55, which I think there is a slight benefit to that aperture. Mm-hmm. It doesn't shift as much. But with this, you have a nice big range, so you have a nice push-in, a punched-in shot that you can go to really easily.
Yeah. And is this lens designed for a certain sensor size?
It is. This particular one is designed for APS-C size sensors.
So that's what we're looking at in like DSLR, Canon DSLR, basically?
Yep, the prosumer one. So we're talking about the T line, like the T3i, T5i, those
the Rebel
cameras.
Line, yep. Yeah.
It should cover on things like the C100 and the C300, because Super 35 is not that much bigger. Mm-hmm. But this one like will not even go on a 5D.
Oh,
it was like the you physically cannot get it on, because the mount is designed slightly differently. Okay. So it won't line up correctly on those, because when you have a sensor as big as the 5D, this lens just won't cover. So you'll have a vignette. So you'll see like the ring of the image and then black all around it.
Okay. So if theoretically you could get the lens on, it wouldn't cover the whole sensor.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yep. And one other cool thing with this particular lens is one thing that Canon just came out with is a servo handle for this lens.
Okay.
So this is a little controller that you pop on underneath the lens, and it basically, we'll see if I can put a link in the description to show you guys what we're talking about, but it's this controller that fits underneath, and it basically adds a motor onto the zoom, so you can have a motorized zoom, which, you know, again, makes it really convenient if you are doing, you know, documentary style filming, yeah, where you want a quick zoom lens that gives a smoother movement rather than you just having to ratchet the zoom yourself. Mm-hmm. So that's another benefit to this lens, is you can get this optional attachment. I think it's like $300 or $400.
So are you using like a remote for that, or is it just like a little button?
There's a button almost like you would find on a servo grip on like the Canon XF-105 mm-hmm. we talked about last episode? Mm-hmm. 2 episodes ago.
Yes, that's the one.
Yep, on a camcorder style mm-hmm. lens, you know, one of those electronic rocker switches. It has one of those that's mounted.
That's really nice side. Because there was a couple times we'd be shooting an event with an EF mounted lens, like my zoom, my 18-135, mm-hmm. and it's really, really hard to get a nice smooth zoom with something like that without yep. an assist. So that's a great add-on mm-hmm. for that.
And definitely with this, this particular servo handle is designed for this specific lens right now. So you can't just take the servo handle and put it on any one of Canon's lenses.
So there are a lot of advantages to having a zoom lens to start out with. But as we've seen with the shorts that we've been filming in the last couple of years, on prime lenses, there's a lot of advantages there as well.
Oh, the prime.
Yeah.
The
so
beautiful prime.
So some of the advantages that we've learned, obviously they're faster, so they let in yep. more light.
Yep, because there's less glass and less movement they have to worry right. about. In a zoom lens, you have to worry about this whole moving element that accounts for the zoom. Mm-hmm. But on primes, all you need to really have that moves is focus.
Okay. So I know that, David, you're a big fan of primes over zoom.
Oh, yeah.
So talk about the set that you've prepared for us today.
Yep. So this has become a very, very popular brand in the last 3 years or so, maybe a little more, become very, very popular. The Rokinon lenses are coming out of China. And this particular set I have, it's the Rokinon Cine DS line, and the DS stands for dual scale, which I'll touch on in a moment. But the most appealing thing about these lenses is they're cheap, which is somewhat of a rare thing when it as far as prime lenses are concerned. These things will probably get you between $450 and $600, depending on the focal distance on it.
Okay, wow.
Well, for the set?
No, per lens.
Okay. For yeah, I was like, whoa. So like, what would you, I mean, comparing like, this is the 24, what would like a Canon Cinema Lens 24
Well, if we're going to Canon cinema lens, then we're jumping into like $5,000 or $6,000.
Okay, so this is like on average 10 times cheaper.
Yep. Though a more appropriate comparison would be to some of, though this is marketed as a cinema lens, they call it Cine DS, it has more in common with some of the Zeiss photo primes, which will, the Zeiss ones are about $1,400 mm-hmm. per lens. So they're still, you're still getting great value okay, compared to these. Or some of like the Canon still prime lenses, which I think are around $600 or $700 for some of the Canon ones. But one of the nice things about these ones is they have a de-clicked aperture, a manual aperture. So you don't have to rely on the camera to use the electronic aperture where you sort of get this click, 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 click as it's going through the different setting, the different aperture points. Mm-hmm. Whereas this one, it is smooth. So you can, so if you wanted to have an iris move as part of your shot, you can have that as a smooth rotation where you're cutting down the light.
Gotcha.
And with the DS, that dual scale is nice because it's saying there is a scale on both sides of the lens. Most still lenses have the scale on the top. I mean, sort of the idea being you have your DSLR, you're taking a still photo and you can look at the top of the lens. But with most cinema lenses, the idea is you have a AC who is pulling focus and they could be on the left or right side of the camera. Mm-hmm. So there's a scale on both sides. So no matter which side someone is pulling focus from, they can see their focus marks on both sides, which is, again, for the average indie filmmaker, may not be that important, but you know, it has the ability to bring these onto actually a little bit higher productions than one would think.
Yeah. What cameras are like compatible with these?
No, these ones, they have them for a whole bunch. I believe they have them for Canon EF, Nikon, and Sony. So they have all these different mounts. These are not things that you can change out at home. You have to order them in one way.
So if you order it online, you have to say, okay, this is for my EF mount.
Exactly.
And, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, at least it has the options. I mean, that's cool.
Yep. And one downside, though, to these lenses, because as I said, though they're marketed as cine, they're more like most still photo primes than cinema primes. And as a result, they are all very, very different sizes. Some are wider diameter, some are longer, some are shorter. Mm-hmm. So when you're trying to pair them up with a matte box or a follow focus system, you have to do more finagling between lens changes because they're they're different sizes. So you may have to swap out the donut on your matte box to make sure you have a solid light seal. You may have to adjust where your follow focus is to make sure it lines up again with the focus ring. So you have to do a little more finagling with that.
Gotcha.
But they have been very, very popular. And actually, Rokinon has a higher end version of them called the Zine, X-E-E-N, the Zine series. And with that one, it is more like the Canon Cinema Primes. So they are all
uniform size?
Yep, uniform size, uniform diameter to make it easier. They're a bit more expensive. I think they're about $2,000 or $3,000. So they're still cheaper than the Canons. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I noticed when I was doing some lens testing with them is these cheaper Cine DS series on the edges of the imaging area were clearer and sharper than the more expensive Zine series.
Why do you think that is?
For what I was able to deduct from it, induct from it, is the Zine series. One thing they talk about is they have more what they call coated layers of glass. When you're making lenses, you usually put coatings on the glass for various optical properties, and on the Zine series, there are more pieces of glass inside it are coated. And as a result, I think that is making more chromatic aberrations in the outer edges of the imaging circle. So that is, you know, if you think of chromatic aberrations, like when you're looking through a couple layers of glass and you're seeing sort of the separation of light a little bit, like you may see the normal white light and then you may see like a reddish edging to it and a bluish edging. You get sort of the separation almost like through a prism. And there's more of that in the more expensive lenses. As I said, I think it's from these extra coatings in there. So why they wanted to put them in, I don't know. So we did find that these Cine DS were sharper.
It's an incredible amount of science that goes into this technology.
Oh, yes. Lenses are a fascinating thing.
Yeah. Well, great. Thanks for bringing us through those. So that's two different options depending on your camera situation. We've got the Canon 18-135, that the upcoming version of
USM
that.
Available now.
And then the Rokinon Prime series. Great. Well, coming up in our Tricks of the Trade, we're going to talk about how to use these lenses for your filmmaking masterpiece. Stay with us. So guys, depth of field, very important in the filmmaking process, and one that is easy to learn, hard to master, I've found.
Yes.
I remember we were filming our Dawn teaser part two, and that was with our Sony Z1U with a built-in zoom lens, and we were trying to get a shot on our talent that was both close up but also had the background kind of out of focus. Beautiful depth of field shot, but we couldn't do it because of the limitations of the built-in lens.
Mm-hmm.
What we tried was, you know, putting the camera back like 20 feet and then zooming in, but then it looked really bizarre, like almost like voyeuristic.
Yeah.
Like, so we just couldn't quite get the look we wanted. But what we'll discuss today is the quality of your lens and whether or not it's prime can play a big part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, to get that shot with a prime is much easier because you can get that nice depth of field.
Yes.
More easily.
Yep. Yep. And you know, we've come a long way in this because one of the things that, you know, when digital first was really coming on the market in the higher end, the broadcast, the TV world, they were using these cameras that have 1/3 inch chips. So the sensor was a 1/3 inch diagonal sensor. Eventually became a 2/3 inch, which is still very small. You know, you can look up online sensor size chart comparisons. So you can see how small these old sensors used to be.
And we can get in more into sensors in a later episode, which I'm sure we will.
Yep. And with that, though, coupled with the way that the broadcast lenses were made, as we were having with our camera, it's very hard to get the shallow depth of field. One cheat that you used to do is you would get a roll of gel, of like light diffusion gel, and you would drop that behind your interview talent, so it would diffuse and blur out the background.
Or maybe then, Vaseline. Oh no, that was for the romantic dreamy shots of actresses back in the day.
Yep. But that's one thing that they would do is they would cheat it, and I think sometimes people do still do it if they don't necessarily have the lenses that are the best for the shallow depth of field. They'll drop these gels behind your person and then use that to blur out the background.
Mm-hmm.
And with modern lenses, the big thing, as far as with zooms is concerned, is when you're dealing with depth of field, a lot of it is this balance between your balance of your aperture and then the ISO of the sensor, basically.
Yep.
Because the wider the aperture, the shallower your depth of field. So, you know, if you're shooting wide open on that lens I was talking about earlier, so you're shooting it at a 3.5, your depth of field will be shallower than if you're shooting at a 5.6.
Yeah.
And trying to do that balance is always a challenge of controlling, again, what your ISO is in that relation to the aperture.
Mm-hmm. The rule of thumb is basically like the more light you can let in through the lens, the more blurry the background will be, or the shallower the depth of field will be. And it's easier with primes because they can let more light in.
Exactly. You know, yeah. As I said, you look at this comparison with that Rokinon, the 24 we're talking about is a 1.5 compared to a 3.5.
Right.
So it's miles faster in that speed range. And you have to be very careful with this though, because sometimes you can make your depth of field too shallow, where it becomes a bad thing.
Yeah,
that's one challenge with things like the 5D, and sort of in relation as well to their sensor size, is you can let in so much light that your depth of field may be an inch.
Yeah.
So when I'm saying that, I mean if you move an inch forward or backward, you're suddenly out of focus.
And that happened a lot when we used a 5D to take behind the scenes pictures during Dawn. A lot of them were out of focus.
Yeah, yeah. It is a challenge to manage, but it is. It can add so much to your shot to have that depth of field, because it's something that, you know, we have been used to seeing in the movies since movies have existed. We have always really had depth of field.
Right.
But TV really didn't until we got into more and more modern, you know, in probably the past 20 years.
More cinematic
cameras. Yeah, more
TV.
Exactly. And so it's this subconscious thing, I think. A lot of it is when you see that kind of depth of field, when you see a rack focus with that depth of field, it makes things more dramatic, more cinematic.
Yeah, well, and back in, I want to say, the mid-2000s, when everyone was after that film look with video, everyone back in those days was like, oh, it's 24 frames per second. If you get that, then your video will just look like film. But of course, as we know now, it's a combination of many things. Not only was it you needed 24, well, it was 24, then it was 24p. Then it was 1080. But the depth of field was a huge contributor to the film look.
Right.
And I think you can almost do 30 frames per second, but as long as you have like the right lighting, right depth of field, it still kind of looks movie-like.
Well, and you were saying, I think you had worked on a couple of projects when you had a a 35 millimeter adapter
yeah.
for a camcorder style camera.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What was that exactly?
Well, so that's kind of a relic from that era. I think the first time I saw that was 2006, 2007. It was with like cameras like the XL. Or the XL2.
Oh, the XL. So those are great looking cameras.
Professional cameras for back in the day for doing video, but you weren't able to attach actual film lenses to them. So what you would do is you attach this adapter that basically made the camera focus on a screen, a see-through screen, and then you would attach a film lens to the end of it. And so the light from the film lens would focus onto that screen, and then the video would basically be recording from that screen. And there were all different types, because one of the problems was, you know, the grain from the screen would show up on the video. So there's ones that like would spin and spin all the dust off the screen. And it was, when you look at it in hindsight, it's like, this is absurd. Why would anyone want this? But back in the day, when you wanted that film look on video, there were a few options, and this was one way to do it.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of that picture with the person with their computer, and they have all the different adapters. It goes like from USB all the way to like yeah. VGA or
right.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and you look at it, and when we were making this transition into digital, there were, you know, there are tens of thousands of lenses that had been used for decades upon decades before that. And suddenly, because of where we were with the sensors and the mounts and whatnot, that you couldn't use them on right. non-film cameras. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, this was an ingenious way of using this brilliant old glass on modern digital cameras
right.
that couldn't accept them otherwise.
And, you know, I think from what I've seen, it looks pretty good, but I mean, with a grain of salt, because the image is degraded more than I would like. Because yeah. you're going through the different mediums to finally record onto the sensor. So it's basically like you have two sensors, right?
Right.
You've got the screen and then the actual camera sensor. So the light is going through two different lenses to get to where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting phase. I actually was pricing one out because I kind of wanted to get one. Because I was like, oh, well, this is clearly the next step for video. But you know, then we sidestepped it with, oh, well, let's just actually make
camera
good lenses, yeah. good mounts and all that, including, you know, the Canon Cinema Primes and all that. Mm-hmm. But then you brought up rack focusing a minute ago. That's another very interesting distinction between zoom and prime. When I was in film school, I was filming with an Arri SR with a zoom lens, and I was so confused because I was doing a pull focus or focus pull rack, whatever. The lens that the image breathed.
Yes, breathing. Yep. That is a big issue with zooms.
And so when you are focusing from something far away to something up close, what you're seeing on the frame will actually expand or contract.
Mm-hmm.
And is very bizarre. It doesn't make it, yeah.
I'm confused just hearing about this.
Yeah. So one weird way I can't remember which one it is, but when you watch Inglourious or Django Unchained, the shot where Samuel L. Jackson's character is in the library waiting for Calvin to come in and talk about how the two main characters are like two-timing him mm-hmm. or double-crossing him mm-hmm. or whatever. It racks from Samuel L. Jackson to the door, and I think it does a little breathe there, mm-hmm. but maybe not. Maybe I'm remembering it wrong.
Yeah, with that, and one, you can attribute this breathing effect because, again, as I referring to earlier, there's so much glass that has to move in a zoom lens.
Yeah.
Because it has to account for that zoom and be holding focus on that zoom and whatnot. So there's a lot of stuff moving about, and there's so much less on prime lenses that breathing is a lot less.
Right.
Sometimes it is considerably less. Sometimes it is almost non-existent if you have a really, really good
so
lens.
So what kind of lenses, prime lenses, do breathe?
From my experience with it, it seems that it almost comes down to like a money thing. Mm. Like if you're willing to spend more on a lens, it's probably going to breathe less.
Get what you pay for.
Yeah, exactly. No. So if you get a Rokinon, it probably is going to breathe a lot less than a Canon zoom lens. Mm. It probably will. But if you compare that Rokinon to a Zeiss Super Speed or the Canon Cinema Primes, those are probably going to breathe a lot less than the Rokinon right. is. And then a $20,000 Cook lens is probably going to breathe a lot less than the $5,000 Canon lens.
And I think, like, you know, how much something breathes in a pull focus can also take away from how professional it looks. Like if it does breathe quite a bit, mm-hmm. it, I guess it makes it look more amateurish.
It can. I can't think of any examples of it, but I can imagine that if you were to be very careful about how you were shooting, you could make use of that, possibly. Like, you know, you could have this moment where if you're racking focus on a character and you and the character is feeling more like closed in, like things around the character are sort of forcing the character to retract into themselves, you can use that breathing to your storytelling.
That's a good point.
As a way of the world closing in around them. I can't think of any moments in cinema offhand that would use it in that way.
Yeah.
But it is a possibility.
Yeah, I like that. It's like you put it. It's just another tool to the arsenal.
Yeah.
Of absolutely. The process. But yeah, the first time I learned that, it just blew my mind. I was like, what? No. Like, pull focuses have to not breathe, like, no matter what lens you're using.
Yeah. Well, I remember also, you know, we were, before we started shooting on Dawn, and we were talking about the lenses, and I said, you know, and I think we were going to use some of your zooms that you own, and some other ones, and like, oh, no, yeah. I can get these on the primes.
Insisted on the primes, yeah.
Insisted on these CP2s.
So we should talk about why you prefer primes over zooms, and obviously they're faster, they don't breathe as much, but what else?
There's two other big elements with most cinema-style primes, and these Rokinons as well. One of them is one I already mentioned. It's the fact that the iris is a manual iris. So you actually, there's an actual ring on the side for it. It's de-click, so it's a smooth iris. So, you know, you can get to more of the exposure you want because you don't have to stick to the predetermined exposure ticks on, like, a DSLR zoom lens. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the focus ring. On most DSLR lenses, if you want to focus from your close focus distance, so that's the closest the lens can resolve a clear image, which could be, let's say 3 feet from the sensor is the closest it can resolve. So that's our close focus distance. And then you have infinity as the farthest it can focus to, if you can say you can focus to infinity.
Right.
On a DSLR zoom lens, that distance is like, I don't know, like 40 degrees or something of movement around the circle. It's not much. So when you're wanting to do a really nice rack focus between some people who are maybe 10 feet apart, it's a really, really difficult focus change.
Because you have to finesse it.
Yeah, your landing spot is much shorter.
Exactly. And don't get me wrong, there are lots of people who are really, really good at it, and they totally make it work, and nothing against that.
Yeah.
But the nice thing with primes is then with those, your focus throw distance is more like 200 degrees or 270 degrees. So you have a lot more, you don't have to be worried about such a minute movement to change your focus. Mm-hmm. And then with that also, the focus distances are very clearly marked. You know, they usually go like 3 foot, 3 foot, 6 foot, 4 foot, 5 foot, 8 foot, 10 foot, 12 foot, 15, 25, you know, it goes up in steps, like it's sort of almost exponential, like the distance gets further apart the farther away you go.
Yeah.
But with that, you have so much throw for it. It's so much easier to get that really nice rack focus between, you know, someone at 3 feet from camera and someone from 10 foot from camera.
Okay. That's really cool. And then you brought up being able to focus to infinity. I was doing some star photography with my 18 to 135 zoom. And what's crazy is, you know, you can do the like little digital 10 times zoom to like get the focus just right. And so you can focus on, it was planetary photography. You can focus on like Mars, let's say. And when you like push it to the infinity focus, it goes beyond it. Like it makes the planet out of focus. And it's crazy to like think about you trying to photograph something millions of miles away, and you can like, it still has to be a precise focus. It's still not infinity. Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yep. And also with the primes, again, you sort of all these things together is really why I like primes more than zooms. I do appreciate the speed of zooms and you can do, and I have done shoots with only a zoom lens on there, and it makes it very quick because you can jump around and get all your shots really quickly. But the qualities of that prime, you know, the shallow depth of field you can get with how fast they are, the ease of focus, all of that together is why I'd rather take the time to swap lenses and get a really, really beautiful frame than to do it really quick with that zoom lens.
So real quick, before we end the segment, we should talk about another minute thing that David insists on bringing to the table when we talk about primes, the warm versus cool look in Zeiss versus Cook. So there's two different manufacturers of prime lenses, Zeiss and Cook.
Or two of the higher end manufacturers.
High end. This is the most expensive ones, some of the most expensive ones.
Yeah.
And Zeiss, you said, is known for its cool look.
Yep.
And Cook for its warm. But when I think about those things, I think about like the lighting and color grading. I mean, how subtle are these looks you're talking about?
It's pretty subtle. It's something that, and in many ways, you could almost say that it might even be more difficult to notice nowadays because there is so much change you can do to that in the sensor itself compared to when you were on film and it's like you're shooting on daylight film stock all the time.
Right.
Versus now when you can finesse your white balance however you want in camera. But with Cooks, I'll start with Cooks, as they are, from every test I've seen, my favorite lenses. They are very expensive.
These are handmade, too.
Yeah, these are hand-assembled. Like
Patron bottles.
Yeah, they're hand-assembled and put together and tested in England. And they are, you know, for the prime lens, like, you're dropping $20,000, $30,000 for one lens.
And if you drop it, you just spend $20,000.
Yeah, you did. you just flushed away $20,000. Right. And one thing that they have touted as one of their things that they have held on to since they were, like, first founded, like, 100 years ago, I think is when they were founded or so, is what they call the Cook look. So it's the look to the image that you get, and they have made sure that has been one of the most important things when they manufacture a lens. So in theory, if you were to take a brand new Cook lens that came off the assembly line yesterday, and you put it up next to a Cook lens that came off the assembly line 75 years ago, they should have the same look to them, the same qualities. And that look is this warmer look. It apparently looks very good on skin tones. And another interesting thing I'll say is, more specifically, probably skin tones on the European and American complexion. I was talking to a gentleman who was a filmmaker in India for many, many, many years. And I was talking to him, we were talking about lenses because he was looking at some for a project he wanted to do. And we were talking about Cooks. And he goes, oh, yeah, I've heard of Cooks, but I've never used them before because we don't use them in India. And he goes on to say that in India, it's not as nice on their complexion, so they prefer to use Zeiss lenses, which are a little cooler. And so that's all that they use in India, all these Zeiss lenses instead. And I think it's important to keep in mind some of these qualities on lenses as they can influence the image and the emotion that comes across during them.
That's interesting. I never would have thought based on complexion, changing your lens choice. But I mean, I totally believe it. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Crazy.
Well, so maybe this is just naive of me, but so if you're going to be doing color correction in the back end anyway, so how much does the color or the temperature of the lens affect?
And I wouldn't necessarily chop it all down to the color of the lens, but it's a certain quality in them that almost you can't quantify. It's almost a subjective look to the lens, that it's that warmer. The other thing that can be said for Zeiss's is they are sharp, very, very, very sharp. And Cooks are softer. They're not like out of focus or soft, but they're softer.
But they feel softer.
They feel softer. at some point, and hope maybe something we can do upcoming, I'd love to do a lens comparison test and grab a camera and put several of these different lenses to show some of these. Sometimes it comes down to this almost more of an emotional look of the lens rather than a technical look of the lens.
That's super interesting. We got to move on, but thank you, David, for running us through all what we need to know when we're looking into.
Oh, we haven't even scratched the surface.
Oh, I know. Sure. I know.
We got 100 episodes ahead of us to do.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to lenses then later one. All right, so coming up, we're going to talk about Sully, Clint Eastwood's new film, when we come back. Sully, we all saw it. What did we think? David, you've been very cryptic and like, you haven't been commenting yet.
Oh, but we know it's going to be cynical, though.
He's going to be so cynical.
People who know me know my usual taste.
Well, I'll
films.
Just say I really liked it. But, David, what did you think?
I thought it was okay. It wasn't great, but it was okay.
Go on.
Clint Eastwood as a director. I'm trying to think of all the... I think the only big film of his that he directed that immediately comes to my mind is the World War II duology that he did. Letters from Iwo Jima and Flags of Our Fathers.
Right.
Of the two of them, I personally liked Letters from Iwo Jima a lot better. because I thought it was an interesting perspective. And I feel like Flags of Our Fathers dealt with a lot more with the sort of aftermath in the States rather than the actual battle of Iwo Jima. Anyway, right. And I really liked that film, as I remember, though it was a long time ago that I saw it. Mm-hmm. But with Sully, we hear about this great director, but I didn't see anything that I would say was unique or special about how this was. Like, one thing I was looking at, just how the story was structured, and it was all, in my opinion, very normal. Like the way they structured the flashbacks, the way the fake out flashback in the beginning, the way they're dealing with all these things was very,
okay.
Like, you know, like that. Yeah, that's how I do it. That's how anyone would do it. You know, it's I wish maybe I was, you know, maybe it comes down to also I don't see a lot of dramas that are set in the more that are in the realistic world. You know, I do tend to go more for science fiction, sure. Fantasy things, but it just was sort of, yeah, okay. It was shot.
Kind of a meh for David. Yeah. Ben, what did you think?
I'm going to kind of be in the same vein as David here. I didn't quite think it was like an Academy Award winning type of film kind of thing I feel like Tom Hanks is always in some sort of Academy Award winning film kind of thing. But I did not know who directed it, but when I went to go watch it, but then when it came to the credits, I was surprised that it was actually Clint Eastwood, and it didn't feel. Yeah, I don't know. It was a good story. I enjoyed it. I thought the acting in it was really great, but yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I will agree that first of all, it's a very brisk film.
It went along quick. Yeah. I was surprised.
It's about 90 minutes or so, yeah. Give or take. Mm-hmm. And I guess the only place that felt odd to me was the very ending.
Yeah,
it ended very briskly.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, are we doing spoilers on this podcast?
Yes,
are
we talking?
Yeah. Granted, most people know
what happened.
How the story ends. Like, obviously, event, you know. And this is dealing more with the aftermath of this very famous. Emergency water landing.
Right.
Not a crash. Water landing. And one of the things that actually, the two things that bugged me the most out of this film. One thing was, I am not one to put huge stock in visual effects. If there are bad visual effects, but the story and the characters and all these other elements are really good, that's fine. I can give visual effects a pass. I don't really care. The airplane in this movie, I thought looked terrible.
Really?
Anytime, because like they use a real plane and some of the takeoff moments and some of the normal flying, but you know, as soon as they switched, like they had to have the plane fly over the Hudson and near buildings, obviously it was yeah. CG. I thought it looked terrible. I thought there was something wrong with it. The plane was not shiny enough, but it was too shiny.
I feel like you could really tell that it was CG.
Yeah.
I guess it just
stood out to me.
In no way did I think that. That's weird. Like,
yeah, and I said usually I can give it a pass if it's okay, but it stood out to me.
So it stood out to you like Neo from Matrix Reloaded, or like some of the like clone troopers in Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, like that.
Really?
Yeah, like it stuck out to me really bad. Like I wish they would have just done a miniature, like just done a model. I feel like I would have liked that better.
Well, it probably would have been more like costly or something.
I'm sure.
Like that.
But anyway, but the more important thing that bothered me the most is the character motivations for the investigators from the NTSB.
Sure.
The National Transportation
and that board. And that's been called out as being controversial because that's not really
exactly.
That wasn't their attitude.
Right. And one thing that annoyed me is like from the get-go when they first start these hearings in the movie, these like the three or four investigators from the board are like they are so set up to be the bad guys.
Yeah.
Like we're wanting to like prove that you did this wrong so we can pin this on you, and everyone is like the audience is meant to not like them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we get to the end and they finally have this reveal of, you know, they have these moments of, oh, this is why we did do the right thing, the pilots did do the right thing and whatnot, and then suddenly in one moment every one of them is like, you're a great man, you're a hero, just out of the blue.
Okay.
no reason for that change to happen.
Right.
Well, I figured that it was because they were in their own public setting that they had to put on a face to seem like they were.
I didn't get that. I felt like it was genuine. Okay. but okay, so that was a sudden turnaround in the climax. I take that, but I don't know. I guess none of those. I guess I was accepting of all the things that annoyed you. I mean, I agree that that's not actually what happened. Like the people,
it was dramatized.
Right. It was heavily dramatized. But for the sake of the drama, I was fine with it. And it was like, it reminded me a lot of movie Flight. There's a lot of similarities. And in Flight, you know, the whole time there was people trying to like call out the pilot with like,
right,
you messed up, this is your fault, which it wasn't. In Flight, he had a drinking problem. So they were trying, mm-hmm, to pin that on him. But, I understand that, you know, people didn't like the manufactured drama, but I guess I was okay with it.
I enjoyed the dynamic between Tom Hanks's character and I think it was his wife. I think it was Valerie Mahaffey.
You're reading it.
I am reading it. I'm trying to. Well, I'm, yeah, it's right. Only the thumbnail. I can't.
I just know her from Love Actually. She's the American.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought it was cool how all of their dynamic was over the phone, but you could definitely get a lot of the emotional connection and the importance of all their conversation and how it seemed like a genuinely very hard time for them, especially when they brought up like how is your life at home?
Yeah.
As one of the questions. It was interesting.
Yeah, and one thing that I liked a lot was where they brought up, oh, well, the left engine was still like operational at idle. And he's, mm-hmm, like, no, not possible. And they're like, well, we have it on good authority that it was, or whatever they said. And just like the thought that like he's like searching his brain, like, oh, and I'm like, oh, it's like
the self-doubt.
Mm-hmm. Self-doubt. There's a lot of self-doubt, which I liked, but also, mm-hmm, like, oh, it's like that. We've all had the moments where it was just like, we've remembered things wrong. And it's like, well, oh, is there just something wrong with my memory now? Like, this is kind of freaky.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. That was really good.
I like that. And, mm-hmm, and, it was cool how it wasn't told chronologically. Like I went back and like looked at Flight after this movie because Flight is told from beginning to end without the flashbacks. And so I think this was cool because I didn't see at the beginning when it was the fake flashback, I thought up until the end of it, that that's what happened. I thought, mm-hmm, they were just setting up the water landing. But then because he's like flying through buildings, I'm like, oh, well maybe that's what happened.
Yeah.
But I think that was a great way to set it up because the whole movie, he was like,
What if
I could I have made it back? Should I have? Like, what if I endangered it? And granted, like, everyone survived, and maybe they played up the drama a little bit, but I still think like they did a really good job of that because you can see that in the tower control dude who was talking to him, like, all right, well, let's go. Let's send you to this airport. Let's send you to that airport. And he's like, I think we got to go to the Hudson. And the guy was like, no, don't do it. Don't go to the Hudson. Cause he's like, people don't survive water landings. And all of a sudden he goes into the Hudson and they immediately like pull him off his job. Yeah. And they're like, all right, well, you know, blood test.
Drugged.
And it's just like, wow, they take this so seriously because there's so much at stake, including a lot of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
That added to the drama to me, but also, I mean, I the reason why I accepted that one panel as the bad guys is because, yeah, like they're trying to, I mean, they were insurance. What were they?
Well, they were the NTSB, so the National Transportation Safety Board.
Okay.
So they're in charge of you know investigating these things
So they're accountable. And let's say things hadn't gone as smoothly as they did, and like, well, a lot of people died. Like, I feel like it's whether or not people died is there's still their duty to like figure out exactly what happened, including being dicks to Tom Hanks. And while we all agree it was played up, I still accepted that.
Yeah. And the other thing that annoyed me was at about halfway through the film, you actually see almost the entire takeoff to crash, mm-hmm, moment. And they show the evacuation and whatnot. And then at the end, they do almost the entire thing again.
Loved it.
I did not like that. I would have rather them have only showed like the evacuation from the plane,
mm-hmm,
and then saved the crash moment until that ending.
I
didn't need to see it twice.
I can see that.
I didn't feel like I needed to see
it twice. I wanted to just because I thought it was so cool.
I think it was nice to have things stitched together at the end because like getting a little bit of each, I didn't get a clear picture.
They do collapse time a little bit in the first time they show it.
Yes, that's true.
And
that's
it's a little more drawn out in the second time. But, which I guess brings me to what I liked most about this film, when they're showing the actual crash. That was my favorite part by far, because again, going back to Flight, when things go wrong in the cockpit, you guys seen Flight, by the way?
No.
I've seen a bunch of the beginning of it.
Oh God.
I'm sorry.
You guys, no excuse. Excellent film. Well, I'm sorry for bringing it up then and talking about what happens in the film, but you guys should definitely see it.
I know what happens.
Anyway, the best scene is in the beginning when they're crashing.
Right.
And the co-pilot is flipping his shit. Like, he is freaking his balls off. And Denzel's calm and collected. But that is such a contrast to how these pilots acted in the cockpit. Like, they were just, like, focused. And
well,
like,
along with Control, too. Control was pretty calm, too. The voice.
Yeah, the tower.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm like, Control.
I thought it was Control. Whatever.
Like, that to me added to a lot of the realism. Or made it feel a lot more real.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was the emotional impact the actual like preparation for the crash had on me, because like in flight you don't get to know any of the passengers, but in this one they set up a few different groups of the passengers, so you get to know who's in the seats. And then when the captain finally comes on and says, "This is the captain, brace for impact," and then all the flight attendants in unison, brace, brace, brace,
right,
heads
right.
down, stay down. Like, I fly a few times a year, and that's a scenario that you never expect to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll never need to know brace positions because that is so crazy.
Yeah.
But then, like, to hear the flight attendants, like, perfectly, like, prepared and, like, calling for brace positions, and just as the plane's going down, like, I was just profoundly emotionally affected by that.
And I don't know.
Were you guys not? Am I crazy?
No. Well,
God damn it. It's a good movie.
I wasn't. Because in the sense, because when I personally fly, if on, for every new airplane I'm on in that flight, I always completely read the evacuation card and I always pay attention to where the exits are. I make that a habit of myself. I always make sure I read every single card, every single information. One thing you got to double check is you got to double check that you have a life preserver under your seat. My dad has been on a ton of flights where his seat did not have a life preserver under the seat.
David,
so you always
got to
check.
NTDs.
So how do you bring this to the movie though? What's your point here?
So my point, like I'm saying, like, this is how, in a certain sense, it gave me an appreciation for those moments, because it's something that, again, like, you know, air travel all said and done is very safe. It's a lot safer than driving, really. And it makes you think about how do you treat air travel, and do you pay attention and those emergency briefings at the beginning? Do you read the card? Do you know where your exits are? How will you react in a crash? And I think that
but it's just crazy, because like I don't see a lot of scenarios where people survive crashes. Even in the safety card, when it shows people in brace positions and then shows the plane going in for a landing, it's like going into the side of a mountain. Like,
yeah.
This was like a best case scenario ultimately.
Yeah, and the other thing that was interesting, I was trying to find some specific examples, but if you saw in the credits, there were quite a few people who played themselves.
Interesting.
In it. I think some of them were some of the reporters that were, not when you saw news reports on TV, but I think one of them, as I recall, was Katie Couric.
Mm-hmm.
There was a shot when she was on the riverbank and they were shooting behind her. That was her, actually her back to do, I think, what she did originally. And there were a bunch of others as well.
Well, she also interviews him.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. That is Katie Couric. I completely forgot about that. But yeah, I thought it was interesting. There were a lot of people that played themselves in the film as
well. What's the famous comedian who was the bartender? I forget his name. But anyway, he's this famous like stand-up comedian from New York playing just a random New York bartender. I thought that was a little funny, because it's like having Jerry Seinfeld just have a random cameo in a movie.
Can we talk about Aaron Eckhart's mustache? The big epic co-pilot,
you know what,
mustache.
That was a great mustache. It was so big I didn't recognize him. I was like, where have I seen this guy? And then I'm like, oh yeah, he's Two-Face.
But
it took me so long because of that mustache to figure out who it was.
I hope it was real. I really hope it was real.
David, did you recognize him right away?
Oh yeah.
No contest. You knew it was a false flashback too in the beginning.
Oh yeah.
How did you know that?
Because that's how you'd start that movie. One of the things I knew coming up to it is because I knew so much of it had to deal with not the crash but the aftermath.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So, and I knew that part of the thing was going to be his PTSD. I think is what they talked up to as well, of reactions of the flight. Like, so this won't be the real one because it's going to be a nightmare.
No pulling the wool over David's eyes. Well, okay, so unanimous agreement, this was a great movie.
Eh.
I don't think it was a bad movie. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good movie. I just don't think it was okay.
Worth 90 minutes of your time.
It was worth 90 minutes.
Sure.
Okay.
Great. Well, both of you can go see Flight now, and we'll have to wrap it up there. But thank you so much for listening to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. We will be back next time to cover, well, I guess we'll have to figure that out, but some awesome new tool and technique slash movie of the film industry. Thank you. We'll see you next time.